All right, welcome to episode 11 of Cryan Mo's Tabletop Alchemy, where I share all the things I get excited about during my midlife return to Dungeons & Dragons, Warhammer, miniatures, and tabletop skirmish games after a quarter of a century break. 25-year break, quarter of a century sounds so trippy. Anyway, sometimes an episode will feature an interview with an awesome miniature painter or a terrain crafter or just another enthusiast. Today, it features an interview with a hardcore commission painter. And sometimes the episodes are just me rambling about a particular topic. As always, every episode contains a hobby progress section and Section Charlie where I shout out something or someone cool that I found on the internet. Hobby related, of course. Anyway, you can listen to this podcast on Cryomo.com, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, Overcast, TuneIn, and the video version can be found on YouTube at youtube.com/Cryomo. The video version just features footage of whatever I happen to have been working on that week at the painting desk or whatever I've got going on at the crafting table. So if you dig the show, dropping a review on your favorite listening platform can go a long way towards helping me find a bigger audience, and that's always much appreciated. You can connect with me on Instagram and Facebook, and I want to give a huge thanks to my patrons on Patreon. Your guys' support, as always, means the world to me, and it helps every day in every way. Yeah, it sounds cheesy, but hey, it's true. Anyway, guys, thank you for joining me one more time for another episode, and today I'm bringing you another interview. We're going to talk to Steve Vu from Houndstooth Minis, and Steve is a, well, I should say Houndstooth Minis, because that's how you'll find him on Instagram and Facebook and Twitter, and also at houndstoothminis.com. Again, you can always find all of these links in the show notes, which is at cryomo.com. So you can definitely go and check out Steve's work on Instagram and on his website. His website's set up like a portfolio website. Super nice. So he's pretty much a full-time commission painter and Twitch streamer. And so you can hang out with him on Twitch and he'll talk to you and chat while he paints miniatures. So our chat runs a little bit long. It's about an hour long. And I want to squeeze in a little hobby progress and a Section Charlie at the end. So let's just jump into it, shall we?
Hi, I'm Steve Vu of Houndstooth Miniature Painting. I am a commissioned miniature painter and Twitch streamer.
And that's how I came to actually, that's how I know about you first, is a year and a half ago or something, I found your Twitch stream. I have a couple questions here to start off.
Sure.
And they're not hobby related because I'm curious about things that are outside of hobby stuff for people. But
okay.
The first thing is, though, this might be hobby related. Can you explain Houndstooth Minis, the actual title?
No, because, well, I can explain it, but there's not that much to it. So I decided I think a week before a local convention, I decided I would start taking commissions.
Oh,
and
goodness.
Start a commission painting business. So I did that thing where I was like, okay, I have a week. It's going to take me like 6 days to get business cards. So I need to come up with a name by like 9 a.m. tomorrow. So I think I had just rewatched that movie Kingsman. I was just thinking about words like bespoke. And I was thinking about that little place that they went to get the clothing
and
the
tailor,
so they get all those special weapons or whatever. And for some reason, like houndstooth pattern, as in like a fabric pattern or a design pattern, came into my head as sort of in the same group of ideas. And so I just latched onto that and was like, that'll do.
and now it's stuck. Now you have it. Very cool.
I get so many other things. People will be like, did you name that after a ship from what's that game? X-Wing? I was like, no, oh. I didn't even realize there was a Houndstooth ship in X-Wing.
I kept thinking that an alternative might have been like a werewolf thing or something. I was like, I don't know. Maybe it's that. But that's cool, man. Right on. Okay. I mean, it's always funny to hear like stories about how company names come to be, because a lot of times they're just like that. They're like, yeah, I had a deadline and I had to come up with something in 5 minutes, and that's what I came up with. That's so perfect. Okay, so speaking of the Kingsman, I did have a question here I wanted to ask you. Just can you tell me just off the top of your head what a couple of your favorite movies are?
Oh, this is okay, this is a good one, but it's a tricky one.
I will
tell you what one of my favorite movies is, and then can I duck the question and tell you a funny story?
Absolutely.
So One movie that I really enjoyed was one I saw last week, and
All
that
right.
movie was Midsommar,
Ooh, I have not seen that yet. No
which I
spoilers.
really, really, really enjoyed. But I want to slip the question for a second and tell you a story, which is I it just reminded me of I was doing interviews for medical residents for a program that I was in years ago. And one of the questions we always asked people was, what's your favorite movie? And these were people that we already knew that generally we'd spent like a month with or something.
Oh.
And what we, but it would always, it turned out to be a really important question for us because we always kind of compared that movie to what we perceived of that person and
Right.
just kind of saw how much it fit. Like certain people would be say like Goodfellas. We were like, of course that person said
Sure.
Goodfellas. And it also was just an indication of how much we already felt like we knew that person.
Sure.
Well, one guy came for an interview and we didn't know him. He had never introduced himself to us before, but he was like the son of a famous so-and-so. And
Yeah.
so he got an interview anyway. And we asked him the question and he just couldn't answer it. He just looked at us and he just started sweating profusely. And so when he answered, finally, after like 25 seconds, it was like the longest pause for anybody just to name their favorite movie. He said, Footloose. And we were like, okay, which one? What I can't remember which of us said it, but one of us was like, which one? The original one or the new one with Zac Efron? He was like, the new one with Zac
Oh
Efron. And
my goodness.
we were like,
Yeah, you can't come into
why?
this building.
And
No.
what and that's not the issue. It's not the issue that that was his favorite movie. It's we asked him why, and he was like, that's the last movie I saw. I saw it on the plane on the way up here. I was
This is
like,
part of
how?
the
How do you
psychopath
get
test,
your
right?
favorite movie question wrong?
Yeah.
Like, that's how you get it wrong. So
Wow.
I just thought of that because you asked me that question, and then the first movie
Yeah.
that came into my mind was Midsommar, but that's only because it was the last movie I
Right.
saw, like, last week. And then
And
I was like, oh, I get it.
that's from the filmmaker that did Hereditary, right?
Yes, but I really love horror movies,
Okay.
and I like Phantasm.
Nice.
I like
Nice.
movies like City of Lost Children.
Oh, yes.
I mean,
Awesome.
I like a lot of Delicatessen from the same director.
Sure.
Now I'm giving you real answers.
Yes.
Enter the Dragon is one of my favorite all-time movies.
All
Babe. Yeah,
right. Good, good.
not
Quite the.
just the last movie I saw.
All right. And Midsommar, I didn't care for Hereditary myself, but Midsommar looks very interesting to me. But I was it when you said that, it made me want to ask you, have you seen the movie Witch? Is it
Yes.
Witch or The Witch? I guess it's The
The
Witch.
Witch, yeah.
Yes. I really enjoyed that. We saw that in the
I
theater and
love
it
it.
was good. You like that one?
I made my mom watch it and she loved it.
Oh, wow. Cool. My mom would not go see that. Not at all. But man, that's pretty cool. Right on. Okay, so we have some. Yeah, I mean, I'm not super into horror. I'm pretty much a movie snob, so I like the really good ones I will enjoy. One of my favorites is like The Shining. I like that a lot.
Yeah, that's great.
This is a weird one. I've never asked anybody this. When you were 10 years old, what did you think you wanted to be when you grew up?
A cartoonist.
Really?
Yeah.
I almost swore
Yeah.
my
When
own
I was
podcast there,
10,
but.
before reality sets in, like at 10, I thought cartoonist. At like 12 or 13, I started telling people I wanted to be the Surgeon General of the United States, which I didn't even know what that was. I just, C. Everett Koop was the Surgeon
Right.
General at the time, and I thought he looked really cool. I guess, I don't know.
Not only were you telling people you wanted to be the Surgeon General of the United States, but you actually know who the Surgeon General of the United States was at that
Yeah,
time.
yeah.
Dude, so cartoonist, man. So do you illustrate? Do you draw for fun? Or do you have
No,
chops?
not since I was like 12. I
Okay.
think I stopped doing almost all visual arts around the age of like 11 or 12.
Huh. All
Like
right.
right around the time that I went into junior high, I think
Yeah.
well, no, in junior high I still did some cartooning with some friends and we did like a little zine or whatever,
Okay.
but I stopped right around then. I completely from then until about 6 years ago, I didn't do any
Wow.
art of any visual art of any kind.
Okay. So last one before we start our the actual hobby stuff, what is one thing we haven't mentioned that you are highly interested in that is not hobby related?
Well, we already mentioned horror movies, and that's
Yes.
probably the number one thing. And
Okay.
people also tend to know that I'm really also into like H.P. Lovecraft type stuff,
Okay, cool. All right.
and related things. But I also am really into fly fishing.
Fly
And
fishing.
backpacking, yeah.
Wow, all right. My exposure to fly fishing comes from the Hannibal TV show.
Oh, really?
Just, you know
I
how
don't even remember it.
he just
Oh, I
makes
do.
making, you know, he's making flies or whatever, you know, making the whatever the the lures, right? Is that what they are?
Right.
Yeah.
Yep.
And I heard a pretty cool podcast about the lures for fly fishing that are like some dude like robbed a museum in Europe. It's a bird museum.
And
He did a full on, I mean, it's a full on heist, but he's just one guy. He just climbed through a window, but he stole like all of this crazy, these feathers. So like these feathers don't exist anymore, but they used to make the lures out of them in like the 1800s. They eventually caught him because he was selling them through this network of like collector fly fishermen. It was crazy. Just this crazy story. But anyway, that's so do you make the lures and actually go out and do fly fishing?
I used to make my own lures before I get into the hobby.
Wow, okay.
Now it kind of competes for time.
Sure.
And I tend to just buy lures more often than not. But yeah, I used to make my own.
Wow.
And I don't fish as much as I used to, again, mostly because of hobby time.
Sure. Man, you're like one of the few people that it's like you have an inverse, like because you're a commission painter, you're like, my hobby time is just, and most people are like, no, my work just doesn't give me enough time, right, to do my hobby. You're like, no, right. My hobby, man, is just taking over all my other stuff that I got to do. But
it's a cool problem to have.
Exactly. It's a cool problem to have. Nice. Okay, man, cool. So let's jump into this a little bit. I got some questions about the models and the miniatures and stuff. So the first thing that I notice on your Instagram feed, and I just recently today realized you actually have a website. So I went there and you have a really nice website. It's super clean. I like it. Portfolio website. Very cool. And nice high-res pictures. So you paint a really wide variety of models. So I'm wondering, what tabletop games do you actually play yourself, if any?
I dabble, as you'd expect. Right now, I mean, things have changed over time. Right now, I'm not actively playing any real miniatures games, but I intend to be playing more Warhammer Underworlds, and I do play that from time to time. That's the one I'm probably actually playing. And I am setting up 4 starter armies for Infinity because I'm trying to get other people involved in that game. So I decided I would take it upon myself to paint 4 armies, get a bunch of terrain, and then just say, hey guys, we're going to be at this place at this time. Come play. You know, nice. I'll teach you how to play. I'll bring all the models. You can play week in and week out. I've got 4 armies until you decide to buy your own army. Like, I always feel like if you want to play a game and nobody in your area is playing it, if you're really dedicated and you really are interested in it, you should take that up as your project and just be like, I'm going to get other people to play it.
Nice.
So that's recruiter. What I'm doing with Infinity, but I'm not actively playing it right now because I'm still in the tail end of that process. Sure.
Have you played it before?
No. Okay. Infinity, sadly, was something I bought all the rule books in second edition, which it turned out when I bought the rule books was like 6 months before they... released a third edition.
Right.
And so I bought all the rule books and read them, and then they were like, oh, third edition's coming out. So then I bought all the third edition rule books and started reading those, and then just life got busy and I never found people to play with. And so that was like 5 years ago.
Oh, wow. Okay. All right. Yeah. Well, it sounds like you're getting close, so that should be pretty awesome. I definitely hope you have I wish you luck in putting together recruiting people to play.
Yeah, I think in October was when I decided I was going to actually start, and so I only have 2 models left.
Wow.
For the first 4 starter armies. So I bought 2 2-player starter boxes.
Okay.
And there's 7 models for each side, so there's 28 models total.
Okay.
And I've got 26 done. So
nice.
I've
All right.
got 2 more to do, and the funny thing is I think there's only like 3 or 4, maybe 4 or 5 of them that are even like showed up at all in my Instagram, like as work in progress, because I haven't based any of them yet. So I have a lot of things that don't get based, so they don't get shown off.
I see. Why is that?
I don't know. Because it's personal stuff, so it just it gets put on the back burner.
Right.
And for me, basing's the part I don't enjoy.
Okay.
So I know a lot of people really are into basing, and I'm just not.
Sure, I get that.
Yeah.
And now, I mean, I was going to ask this question later on, but I'll ask it now anyway. Because you're a commissioned painter and you do so much work, I was curious about, you know, how much personal work do you get to do, if you even do any? So, like, apparently you've done some because you've done these Infinity models. Are those the only? Is that the sum total of personal miniatures you've painted since October?
Pretty close, but not exactly. I have painted a couple other models for Blackstone Fortress. But the way that I've mostly been doing it is I set aside a 4-hour stream on Thursday nights that has been just for Infinity. which, okay, because I haven't had a lot of Infinity commissions, has meant that it's been my own time.
Oh, okay.
So that's always like every Thursday night from 6 to 10 has been a time that I have been working on my Infinity models, which has given me like that little chunk of time in the week that I get to work on my own stuff.
That's great, man.
And I've gotten a couple other models and projects done. I've gotten a couple other. I actually got two kill teams done. It was a kill team box set. It was the Rogue Trader box set.
Oh right, yes.
I got that done as well. So that's another whole bunch of models.
Yeah, very cool. All right. Well, that's good, man. It's good to have a little bit of balance in there. You're able to get something done for yourself. Cool. Okay. So here's the big question, of course, is how did you first get into miniature painting 6 years ago when you returned to doing visual art type stuff?
Yeah, so I was living in New York City and I met a bunch of dudes at a party, and they were playing a game called I don't remember the name. I want to say it's called Hex, but it was called Hive. They were playing a game called Hive, and it was just this game that used these like special tiles, and I instantly became like best friends with four of those guys. Okay. And we wound up having like a board game night every week, like Wednesday night, for years and years. And so I got really, really into board games. That was in like 2010.
Okay.
In 2012, I got introduced to Kickstarter because a couple of board games that I was interested in were being reprinted on Kickstarter, or, you know. So I started looking at Kickstarter on a regular basis, just browsing to see what was happening. And so in November of 2012, Kingdom Death, the first Kingdom Death monster project, was on Kickstarter.
Oh, right.
And I backed it. And I don't know if you're familiar with Kingdom Death,
but it's like
a giant box. Yeah. Right. So I backed it, and I knew I was going to be getting a copy of it. And I thought some of the models, particularly the Flower Knight, were so amazing that I had to be able to paint it. So I started thinking about that, but I knew I had some time because they said that it was going to take at least a year, and it wound up taking 3 years. But I thought it was going to be a year before I'd get my models. So the following spring, in March of 2013, I went to PAX East. It's a big convention in Boston that's both tabletop and video gaming. And while I was there, I saw the Privateer Press booth, and I had never been exposed to War Machine before. And while I was there, I bought a two-player starter box, and then I took it home, and I bought paints and started painting it. And the intent was to learn how to play it, because it seemed like a cool game, but the intent was to learn how to paint on those models so that by the time, supposedly 9 months later, when I would get my Kingdom Death, I'd be pretty good at painting, and I could paint it. I had another 2 years after that before it showed up, and I actually was better than I thought I would even be by the time it finally arrived.
What kind of paints did you start with originally, and what kind of paints do you use now?
Okay, so when I first started, I started using Reaper Master Series paints and a few Citadel paints. And the reason was that was what my local store had. So I was living in New York City in Manhattan at the time. And if you've ever investigated gaming in Manhattan, there's one store. I mean, it's a giant city, but the problem is that there's no space. And game stores take a lot of space, and the space is very expensive. So there's this one store called The Complete Strategist, which is on, like, 33rd Street. And you go in there, and it's amazing because it's the type of place where all the games are stacked up, like, 14 feet high up the walls. And they had a rack of Master Series paints, and they had a rack of Citadel paints, and I had no idea what the difference between the two was other than cost. So I bought a handful of each. Okay. And I just started by buying the paints I needed for the models I was working on. And this is still what I recommend to new people. And then I just went back to the store each time and grabbed another handful of paints. I just bought them a few at a time. And then over time, I stopped buying the Citadel paints. Years later, I would start buying the Citadel paints again when I became a commission painter, because I felt like I needed them to do Games Workshop models for people that wanted those specific colors.
Sure, I see. Like people that wanted box art or that kind of stuff.
Yeah, and I do a lot of that. And these days, I use primarily Reaper Master Series and Vallejo and Scale, mostly the Fantasy and Games line.
Okay.
And Citadel. So I'd say those four brands are the ones I use the most. But nice. I use a little bit of everything.
Okay, cool. Yeah, I was curious since you started with the War Machine models, but I was curious if you used any P3 paints, but it sounds like you didn't. You never went that route, so never tried them out.
They just didn't have them for me to buy locally, and I didn't start off by buying all my stuff online.
Yeah, I can totally see that being an issue, yeah. So you got those paints, you're collecting, and you're getting geared up to do your Kingdom Death set and everything. So how do you get into commission work.
I was just at a point where I had basically left what I was previously doing. So I was just at a weird transition point where I was like, okay, I have made a conscious decision to not pursue the career that I've just spent 7 years training for.
Excellent. Thumbs up.
All right. It's like a really poor life choice. Essentially, it's the product of an extremely poor life decision. So, I mean, it isn't. I joke about it. Right. I'm laughing. But I decided not to go forward with what I had been doing. So I was just like, well, can I make this work? And the answer seemed to be no. This is crazy. You shouldn't do this.
Right.
And I would say to 90% of people that are like, hey, I'm thinking about doing commission painting, and the answer is don't do it. It's crazy. Why? Don't do it. But yeah. I did it, and it worked out thus far.
The lesson to all the kids out there is take the risk.
I guess.
But at your own risk, right? I mean, just take the risk because, you know, no risk, no gain, that sort of a thing.
I think I was already in a position where I was already in a bad position.
Right.
So the risk was low.
Right. You're like, it doesn't, it's going to be worse, right? I'm already eating top ramen. Come on.
I didn't leave a top paying job or anything. It wasn't like I had like a $200,000 a year job and like got up from my desk and was like, I'm leaving. I'm going to go be a commission painter.
Right.
That's a little crazier and I didn't do that.
I do think that's a wonderful sentiment though. I do think this is something that I would seriously say, this is a lesson for people listening. Not a lesson, just a piece of advice, not even a piece of advice, just a notion that you should consider. And that is, it's always okay to change your mind, to change your direction, to do something else you want to do. There's no reason to feel like because I did this one thing for 5 years, I have to stay locked in this thing. No, that is not what life is about.
Right.
You know, life will open up doors. You have to look for them and they're never what you think they're going to be. That's the thing, right? You're always like, well, I want a lateral transition. You know, I want to maintain the same lifestyle and step over here and do the same thing. It's not going to work that way or that easily, but you can go and experience different things. You don't have to feel like you need to stay in this rut just because you're doing this one thing. It's like, who cares, man? It's life, dude. Live it, right? Do the thing you want to do. I think that's great. Give me a little bit more detail, just a little bit of detail. Like, so how did you initially do that? Did you actually, did people like come up to you ahead, like just before you'd made that decision and were like, hey, can you paint these for me? Or did you consciously set up like a business plan and like go forward on that?
It sort of started with a conversation I had with somebody at a party that I was just talking about how I painted, and I didn't know that this person was really into Warhammer.
Okay.
But had like a huge collection of stuff that wasn't painted. I didn't know that.
Sure.
But at the end of that sort of conversation, we started talking about it. He's like, hey, I have some stuff. If you want to paint it, that, you know, that'd be great. You know, and we just kind of talked a little bit about that. And then I took that and went home, and I was talking to some other gamer friends that I knew that I played board games with, and they were like, oh, hey, I've got these. I had somebody else that used to paint my stuff for me, but he's gone. Do you want to try tackling a few of these? So I did. And that's kind of when it started. And then after that first few models that I painted, I think I painted like 5 zombie side heroes.
Okay.
I was like, this is fine. And the thing was, I knew right off with those that I wasn't really in the profit zone, so to speak. Like, sure. I knew I was almost doing them for free, but for that, I was okay with it.
Sure.
Because I was just trying to like price match this other person that had been painting for him. And at that point, I wasn't even technically a professional
At this point, it's still an experiment, right?
Right. So I did that knowing, okay, well, I probably can't continue this, but let's give that a try. And then I just decided, okay, I'm just going to like hang a shingle essentially like on the internet essentially, you know,
sure.
And go to a convention, hand out some business cards. The person that I originally had that conversation with at a party came back like a month and a half later and was like, oh, hey, let's actually do some stuff. And so then I started doing things and I found some people on the internet. That's the craziest thing is like people just find you. You know, you just put your name out there and you put up a little website and you put up a little page on Facebook and you can't even explain it. I mean, I thought after the first year and a half or 2 years, I thought that I would get a lot more word of mouth and get a lot more people that came from specific Facebook groups or like that there would be like a pattern of where people came from.
Right.
But even at like the 2 year point, most people just emerged from out of nowhere. And I would say, hey, how did you find me? They're like, I just like put in a bunch of words on the internet, your name came up. I was like, Perfect.
Yeah.
Okay, cool.
All right. I like the way the universe is working at this point. Very cool.
Yeah.
Man, that's pretty awesome. I love the term to hang a shingle. Houndstooth pattern and hang a shingle go together, man. Both bespoke
yep.
terms. Do people, when they hire you, do you paint for hard deadlines, or how do you manage the time with painting? I know you do different, there's different levels that people pay for, but I'm
right.
still wondering like about deadlines. Are you like, okay, this is going to take as long as it takes, or I get this to you, you know, in a week, a month, whatever. Do you set hard deadlines for yourself?
I set a time frame, but I never really consider it a hard deadline, and I don't push it that way.
Okay.
I try not to imply that it is. I give somebody an idea of how long I think it'll take, with the understanding that it might not be exactly that. When somebody has a hard deadline, like a tournament, and I agree to that, that's a hard deadline.
Right.
But that doesn't happen that often. I'm actually surprised. I think going into it, I thought that would be more of a thing.
Right.
And I've only had like two hard deadline tournament armies, or you know, sets of models
yeah.
that were like, hey, I've got to go to this thing on this day, make sure that we you
right.
know, I have it before I leave. The way I typically do it is people reach out to me and they tell me what and actually, if you don't mind, I'm just going to go through the whole process of booking a commission,
yeah,
because
do.
People seem really confused about this sometimes. And to me it makes sense because I do it, but I know that sometimes people are really confused about how the whole process works.
Sure.
So like, for instance, I had one guy that didn't even know what models he wanted painted for like a month. And I was like, usually like when a person approaches me, they have an idea
right.
of what models they want painted first, you know, so I don't spend a month communicating with them and they don't know what models they want.
Right.
So
yeah, seems
yeah
odd.
Usually somebody reaches out to me and says, hey, I have these models. Can you paint them? And then I reach out back to them. And I'm like, hey, can you give me an idea of, well, I want to make sure I know exactly which models they are and how many,
right.
What, you know, what specific requirements you have. Do they have to be in certain colors? Do you have a hard deadline? Do they have to match anything else? You know, those are the things that I sort of need to know. Then once I get all that information, I work out a little quote and I figure out how much I think it's going to cost. And I kind of break it down per model, especially in case they say, oh, well, actually I have two units of those. I'd like to add a second unit, whatever.
Sure.
That just makes it easier. And then I include what I always list, what is and is not included. Like, just kind of is almost like a soft contract too, just saying,
sure.
hey, I'm letting you know that that price does not include me buying the models for you, or
right,
things like
right,
that.
Right, yeah.
But then I include a time frame. I switched the way I used to do time frames. I used to just say first come, first serve. So the next person in the door
oh,
is the.
Right. Okay.
So it was like this job, then this job, all in a line in a queue, and it doesn't work because sometimes certain jobs have like a little break where there's like 2 days where you're waiting for the oil wash to dry or like whatever
sure.
it is. It actually sometimes makes sense that this one thing kind of just happens because it only takes 4 hours or whatever. So to try to do them in order just doesn't always make a lot of sense. I still try to honor it, you know, in an order. But what I also had to change was to honor them in the order that the deposit comes in. And
oh,
that I
right.
have the models, because one of the things that will sometimes happen is somebody will, you'll go through the whole process and they'll agree to your quote and they're like, okay, we're good to go. And then nothing, like they disappear.
Right.
And you might be for a couple of days, like hanging on. So then let's say it was like this big job that was going to take 6 weeks. And then somebody comes in the next day and you're like, well, hey, I'm still, you know, my time frame I have to give you is extended because I'm thinking there's this other job that's going to be 6 weeks.
Right.
And so if you keep trying to cram in these imaginary jobs that are long, you're telling other people that your lead time is longer and it's going to take longer to get to their job, even though that's imaginary and that's not going to be the way
right.
it happens. So I always tell, like, there's like a bit of copy and pasted text essentially at the beginning of every time frame thing. This depends upon, you know, the
sure.
moment that I'm telling you right now, and you know, tomorrow this could be different, and it depends upon a timely deposit and getting the models in a reasonable amount of time. Sometimes, I mean, there've been a couple times where people took a month or two to send me models. You know, it's
oh,
like
right.
we booked it, I have a deposit, but I didn't receive the models for like 4 or 5 weeks.
Right.
So that also puts a big wrinkle in stuff. And in that case, I just keep pushing it back. It's like, well, then I'll just take all these other jobs and finish
yeah.
those, and when your models arrive, then they'll be kind of put back in the queue.
That's good. That's all good. That's all like fairly typical freelancer kind of stuff. I mean, yeah, you know, different ways that freelancers have to deal with things. But yeah, that's good though. That gives a definite...
Freelancers think that way, but the clients don't.
Correct.
So I think sometimes people get confused.
That's definitely how you learn as you go as a freelancer, is how to put language out there at the beginning for clients, because you know they're not seeing it from your perspective. So you're like, you got to prep them for all these different things.
You can never completely
that's true.
Like take care of every situation. Right, I keep finding new ones and I'm like, I never thought this was something I needed to protect myself against.
Right.
And yep. It just keeps happening. It's just something crazy. Nothing bad, but just,
sure, no. It's yeah. always though a constant learning process. I mean, life is a learning process. All right. of life is a learning process. It doesn't matter how much of a...
Well, like, I never thought I needed to tell somebody they needed to figure out what models they wanted painted well, first.
That's an interesting one, yes. That is pretty wild that they would come to you and be like, hey, I want to hire you. For what? I'm not sure yet. Okay.
Yeah.
That's a good one. Wow. Okay. There's three, like, big questions I want to ask. Okay, but I got to pick one. Pick one in order. I'm as you can see, I'm terrible at segues. So because of the volume that you paint, do you ever deal with motivational issues and or burnout?
I've been doing really well for quite a while. I definitely do, but it's been so long that I almost forget what burnout feels like.
Okay,
it's probably been at least a year and a half since I've had real burnout. Like
okay.
real deep burnout. And I haven't, I experienced worse burnout before I was a commission painter. I think in part because now that I'm a commission painter, I get through a larger volume of stuff and get a greater variety.
Okay.
And the variety is really helps prevent burnout for me.
Okay.
So I think if I was just working on one thing for way too long, I would
sure.
be far more likely to burn out. But because I'm constantly switching it up,
right.
That helps a lot.
So like, yeah, somebody comes in like, I have 1,000 Space Marines, paint them all the same. That would be a problem.
Yeah, that would probably be
yes.
really hard. I think the last time that I was a little bit worried about burnout, I mean, the last time that the only commission job that I actually got really burned out on was my first big army. And that was also the first time that I really went past a deadline. It wasn't a deadline really, but I had set an initial like, hey, I think it's going to take this long, and I think it took like three times longer, but when I explain what it is, it might make sense. It was a giant Harlequins army.
Oh,
all in freehand diamond.
Oh,
and
man.
that burned me out hard.
Yeah, I can see that.
That was my first, and it was my first big army commission.
Oh, man.
So I really just didn't know what I was doing. But that person, I still work with that person all the time. Like,
okay,
he's still a client. We still work together on a million projects. So it worked out.
That's awesome.
And it turned out to be a great army, too. It was really hard because I was like, I spent weeks and weeks painting freehand diamond.
Right.
And I was like, I don't want to do this anymore.
This is very uplifting to hear because of you talking about having been through burnout, but here you are rejuvenate, you know, you're still, now you're positive, you're still working on it. And that's just a good thing for people to hear too, you know, like people can go through burnout and come out on the other side.
The other thing that I think has helped with the painting burnout, but has led to another type of burnout, is actually the Twitch streaming, because the Twitch, I'm never alone.
Yeah.
There's something about like having all these other ideas and things going on while I'm doing whatever it is that I'm doing that prevents it from getting too tiring.
Right.
Or boring, because I'm talking about tacos or like we're having a discussion about like comic books or whatever
right.
it is. Just keeps your brain off of it in such a way that you're not burning out on whatever your hands are doing.
That literally segues right to my next question, which has to do specifically about being a Twitch streamer. How do you handle dividing your attention when you're streaming, right, between the work you're doing on the desk and, of course, paying attention to your audience and holding a conversation with people that are not in the room with you? To me, it's very different to paint a miniature while you're streaming for other people and holding a conversation and just painting a miniature for yourself in your room by yourself, listening to whatever.
They are very different. They're definitely very different. People sometimes ask me, they're like, hey, doesn't it take you so much longer to paint a model if you do it on stream? I think people sometimes get concerned because they know I stream. They're like, oh, does that mean you're going to take forever to paint my models?
Right.
Well, no, because for me, no, because when I am on Twitch, I am stuck at the desk. I can't get up and like go watch a movie on
Right.
Netflix or like walk around outside or like do whatever. I'm at the desk and I'm working on the stuff at the desk. It keeps me locked to the desk in a good way, and then I get stuff done. It does slow me down a little bit because I'm looking at the
Sure.
screen and reading chat. So there's that, but I definitely know overall I'm far more productive if I am tied to the desk and focused on the project
That's pretty
than if I'm
interesting.
just like able to go to the kitchen and make a
Right,
meal.
right.
Like,
You're
you
able
know,
to not
it's hard when
paint
you work from
somehow.
home. Anybody who works from home knows what I'm talking about. Like, it's so easy to just like
Oh,
go
yes.
to something else.
Oh, yeah. I put a lot of Overwatch hours in for that exact issue right there.
I think the people that have stuck it out with me as my audience also are willing to put up with the fact that I am not the best at keeping up with chat. So
Okay.
for me, there's like a certain amount of attention that has to be given to the models, and I'm still not really willing to just completely put them down and just
Sure.
focus on chat for 20 minutes or whatever. I don't do that. Like, that's not what I do. So
That's
I
good.
try to keep up with everybody, but I think most people understand that for me, there's a certain amount of focus that has to stay on the models while, you know, to
Right.
stay productive. Otherwise, I just can't stream, period. Like,
Right.
you know, because streaming itself isn't a source of income. I mean,
Right.
it is, but it's not a significant one.
Right.
So if it starts to interfere with me doing commission painting, if I'm going to continue to be a commission painter, then I have to stop streaming. But I
Right.
found that balance. And sometimes I have to tell people, because like I've had a few people that get really, you know, upset because I missed the line of their chat.
Pay
They're like, oh,
attention to
hey,
me.
buddy, you didn't respond to me. I'm like,
Right.
hey, come on.
Yeah.
You got to understand. I mean, usually other people try to point it out to me or just like tell that person to shut the hell up or
Right.
whatever it is. But, you know, there's a certain understanding that there has to be between audience and streamer of this is what's happening. You know, I'll
Excellent.
keep up as best I can, but you have to understand the parameters.
Good. That's an excellent way to put it. Gives me a definite perspective then on that, how you handle that whole thing. I think that's very cool. Besides just the pure act of constantly painting, are there things that you do to consciously help yourself like improve in the painting game? Or like, do you assume that you're, I mean, are you just improving just through pure volume, or do you have other techniques or things that you consciously set out to like, okay, on this model, I'm going to, as an example, like, oh, I'm going to try this particular kind of technique or something? Like, is there stuff that you do consciously other than volume to improve painting, or do you just paint and don't worry about that?
Actually, for me, it's just volume, but there's a reason, and the reason is something that I've been trying to get across to a lot of people. I just started teaching painting
Okay.
online, and so one thing that I've been really trying to explain to people is that the most important thing if you're trying to improve is that you have to understand what it is you're doing and why you're doing it. So it's not enough to just be told, oh, hey, when you use this color as a base coat, use these colors as highlights. Like, why?
Right.
What is the relationship of those colors? Like, learning color theory, learning various things, learning the properties of paints and additives and how to manipulate them, what they actually are rather than just what it says on the bottle is important. And once you actually get that foundation laid, then it can just be volume, because volume starts to present you with opportunities to understand those fundamentals better.
Right.
But if your volume is just you taking GW formulas and applying them over and over again, because you'll see a lot of people that have been doing commissions and taking commissions for like 15, 20 years, and they just take the same formula. They're like, oh, well, it was Evil Sun Scarlet, so I put Fire Dragon Bright on it. And
Right.
their stuff never changes, or it doesn't really seem to improve, because everything is just rote and not
Right.
based on like fundamental principles and like learning new things and trying out new things. And so I guess I'm always trying out new things, but it's not something that I'm pushing myself to do. Like, I don't set out to be like, I have to do something new today I've never done.
Right.
It's just that if I'm doing enough volume where I have enough new projects coming in, and if those projects are varied and I have all these things that I've never done before, like, oh, this has to look like deer skin or whatever, then you just have to push yourself to figure out how to do that. But you should have the tools in your toolbox already to start
Sure.
to try to apply it. So volume to me is the most important. Doing models and getting them done and doing a variety, I think is where it's at. But I don't think that works all that well in a vacuum if you don't also work to have like really solid fundamental knowledge.
Right. Excellent answer to that. And I think that's one, the one detail that you point out there, I think that makes volume work for you as far as helping you progress is the constant variety. Like you're saying, like if you just had volume, meaning you just painted a space marine every day for the rest of your life, you're not going to improve much. But the fact that you paint such a varied a number of models, there's so many, like I'm just, your website is up in front of me, so it's just scrolling through the slideshow, right? And just the main, like the top three, like images, they're so different from each other right off the bat, right? So you do so much different things, which actually brings me to another question I had, which is about, like, you paint a wide variety of not only like miniatures from different companies, but also different scales of miniatures and different sized miniatures. You know, you do a lot of 28 millimeter miniatures, but there's a lot of like just
the
miniatures
big bosses.
The big bosses and then robots and whatever. And can you talk a little bit about the difference between attacking a standard 28 millimeter model and something that's much larger?
Yeah, it's really, really different. I love the large surfaces on big models. When you get to a larger model, though, I think that sometimes because of the big surfaces, I feel like texture becomes a much bigger issue. So even when you get to something the size of, like, I don't know, I did an Abaddon the Despoiler.
Yes.
And he has that cloak. And for me, when I saw it, the first thing I knew, like right off the bat, was that I had to do a texture on that cloak. So I don't know if you've seen the picture, but like if you look at the back of it, I spent like hours and hours stippling in that texture on that cloak. But I knew like for that model, because it's so big and because that cloak is so prominent, it had to have that extra something. And, you know, when things are really small, you don't have the luxury of that all the time because it's just too crammed in. It's not going to look like anything.
Right.
But
it's
as you get
small,
bigger and bigger, it gets more important that you throw in more texturing and more specific light source type stuff. I think, and that gets a little bit tricky because with something I've been talking about a lot with light sourcing is that when you're doing a diorama, you typically want to have like a very distinct light source, right? So you
Right.
pick your light source because that's going to be the light source for the entire diorama, and that figure has to be lit exactly like it's in that one light source. If you're not doing a diorama and you're doing a game piece, right, which most of these figures are,
right,
if you light it like it's lit from the front, right, like if there's a light source
sure.
kind of shining from the front of the model, then the back should be almost entirely in shadow unless there's a lot of ambient light or there's a second light source. So when you want to make something really dramatic, you'll often paint it like it's got this nice frontal light or semi-frontal light, which is really cool and looks really dramatic and great. But then if you turn the model around and you're entirely consistent, then the back's going to be completely boring.
Right.
So what I've started doing for game pieces is I always imagine several conflicting light sources. That
right.
If you could see both views at the same time, don't look right. But you can't,
right?
Because you can never look at the back of your head. Like it's
right.
just, it's one of those things. So I tend to think that through, and I do that more with the big pieces, especially because it's like you want to have really dramatic lighting, but you also need to make sure it looks good from all angles, especially if it's going to be on a game table, because
you can see it
the
from
very
all
least
angles.
You're going to have two people looking at it
right.
from opposite
yes.
sides of the table
yeah.
simultaneously. Plus, people are going to be moving around, and the model's going to rotate, and whatever. So.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know if that even answers the question.
Oh, yeah,
but,
totally. Yeah,
yeah, with the small models, it's, I don't know, it's hard. Like, sometimes it's harder to be really dramatic with the lighting. Sometimes you don't have enough room for texture. But the big models just give you a really big canvas to play with. So I've done three models in the last few months that I'm super proud of. I think they're my three best models, and they're all huge. They're all
okay.
big models.
Very
The Magnus the Red...
Yeah,
the
he's
Abaddon.
I was going to mention that one for sure.
Yeah, the Abaddon the Despoiler,
yeah.
or Abaddon, I have no idea. Sometimes I say it one way, sometimes
right.
I say it the other way. And the third one was the Great Unclean One. I painted a Great Unclean
yeah.
One with like whitish-bluish skin, and I think that one might be my favorite, but that's also the last one I did, so.
Okay. Yeah, the Magnus the Red is pretty spectacular, man. I really like that one.
I like painting those big GW models. I mean, it's they just give you so many areas to work on, and it's really fun to have all that area to play with. I mean, I love the smaller models too. You know, they have so much character, and you can get them done faster. But it's just nice to have that big piece where you can really show off. You know,
absolutely. And to mention the small ones, I mean, some of the more recent ones I've seen on your Instagram feed are super tiny. They're those tiny raging heroes, like the little ones, like the stray kids.
Those are small.
That's
pretty
cool.
I should have put up a little coin or something for reference, because those are actually really, really tiny.
The baby hippo and the leprechaun girl, like, those are my favorites. I love all the small ones that you did, but the hippo, I love the skin tone on the face. Actually, the face of the leprechaun girl too. I don't know why, that those two are really, I was like, those are, I don't know, I just really like those.
I did a lot of looking at photo reference for hippo skin.
Nice.
Like I spent like an hour just looking up photos of specifically baby hippos. You'd probably be surprised how many photos of baby hippos there are on the internet, but there's lots. So
Excellent, man.
What I'm starting to do, and I mean just starting it as an artist, I didn't used to do this, but I'm starting to think about composition more.
Okay.
Like the Bad and the Despoiler, I did that a lot because he had all these red elements, but I actually figured out a way to put all the red elements in a line.
Right.
So they actually
from the top
this, like,
skull
diagonal
to his
line
hair
across
down to the
yeah.
Yes. Yeah.
And I was like, it's just gonna make this slash across him of red, and it'll look really like violent. And I was like, oh, that's gonna be really cool.
That's good.
So yeah, so I'm starting to like do that more, where you'll just pick one part and you're like, okay, well this has to be this way. Because I asked that client, it was like, what color do you want the Space Marine helmet, like what chapter?
Right.
And he said Blood Angels, so that kind of set the whole thing up, and I was like, okay. That's red, so then all this other stuff's gonna be red. A lot of it beyond that is goes to like more theory stuff, where it's like, okay, I need to think about warm and cool colors, I need to think about neutral, you know, saturated and desaturated colors, I need to make sure that of all the things that can be contrasted, that there's some amount of all of that contrast somewhere in the model.
Right.
And so a lot of that is just like, it's almost checking off boxes, or determining when checking off that box is too costly. You're like, okay, well, I could put in some complement contrast here, but it's just going to be not worth it, or it'll look too weird. So I'll just skip complement contrast and move to the next type of contrast. And, you know,
and this all speaks to this all speaks to experience too, through that whole thing we were talking about, learning through volume and just progressing through volume work. Like, obviously you can make these sorts of decisions because you've done so much. You know, so you've got so much experience. You know, when you're first starting out, people should understand, of course, when you're first starting out, don't worry about that. You're not going to be able to think about all that stuff, or you're not going to have boxes to check off yet.
So, right. You know, just get models done. Like,
yeah, exactly. That's where I'm at. Like, okay, I'm going to get these models done. Maybe in a year I'll think about what colors I should have used on them.
Yeah, and the thing is, like, I don't even ever look back, and I wouldn't say never look back, but like, don't even judge your old models. Just don't worry about it. Like, it is what it was, and that's great. That, like, once it's finished, it's good. Like, by definition, if it's done, it's already a good model.
Right.
So then just worry about the next one. The only models that you need to be critiquing are the ones that aren't finished.
Right.
Any ones that are finished, A-okay.
Perfect,
A+,
man.
10 out of 10. But it's only excellent. The ones that aren't done are the ones that you should be, like, worried about.
Backwards.
And don't strip and restart. I think that's a lot of people, well, you know, if you only have X number of dollars for models, okay, I can understand. I only have this one model, I'm just going to paint it 7 times. Okay, fine. But most people have a giant pile of shame that they can delve into for 30 years and paint. So just finish it, move on, don't strip and repaint, and keep those first models. Whatever your first model was, I have right now within arm's reach my very first model. I painted the Kador Warjack that came from that 2-player starter set.
Excellent.
Like, it is always on my desk, and I always look over at its dusty exterior and go, wow, okay, cool, we've come a long way.
Right. That's excellent. That's an excellent motivator right there. Like, this is a nice way to keep your spirits up. Do you have a favorite or a particular painting technique that you generally like that you use a lot, or is there something some particular style or technique that you really enjoy doing in painting miniatures?
Yeah, there's one technique that I've been abusing a lot lately, and that's stippling.
Okay.
So I stipple everything now.
Wow.
I'm starting to just do it just for fun. Like, I don't have to stipple this. I probably shouldn't stipple this, but it's more fun if I do, so I'm just going to stipple it. So, and I'm getting better at it and faster at it. And so I stipple a lot of stuff now, and I like that because it adds a lot more texture. So I'm always trying to find the cool thing about stippling is that you can use stippling to create any texture, because you can create dots and dashes, and then you can just combine dots and dashes in so
Right, I
many
see.
ways to create so many different, things. If you can create perfect little circles, or not even perfect, but if you can create enough little circles, I mean, you can essentially create anything, because I mean that's how like print is done, really.
Correct,
It's like
right?
just little dots.
Halftones or
So
whatever, yeah.
I've really been doing a lot of that.
That's pretty interesting, man. Yeah, I have done very little of that, but I just recently started trying that myself, and I'm like, ooh, yeah, this is something that I can see the potential in that, something that I had never done before, but very
For
cool.
people that get intimidated by doing wet blends, that want gradients but find blending really intimidating, stippling is the easiest way to get a gradient,
Wow.
because all you have to do is change the density of the dots. So,
Right.
at one end you pack the dots really tight, at the other end you just put them really far apart, and then from 2 feet away that looks like a really nice gradient.
Nice.
And
That's a good idea.
so, yeah, I mean that for people that get really intimidated by, not that little dots aren't intimidating, because those
Right. Oh,
can be
sure.
too.
Right.
But some people are just extra intimidated by wet blending, especially, some people live in like desert environments and places
Yeah.
where wet blending is like impossible. It's really, really difficult. So I could totally see why. Hey, this other technique doesn't require you to work with wet paint. You just put down a bunch of dots and let them dry.
That's what I hope
And
is my problem. I hope it's where I live, because with
yeah, I
blending,
mean,
because I'm
I.
like, why can't this work? But I don't think that's really the problem. I think it's operator error, but
It could
it's
be,
all fine.
could be. People are always asking for really hard, definitive answers to questions, and
Right.
I try not to give them.
Sure.
I try to explain why I can't give them, because like for instance, I have a friend that lives in Australia, and it is so dry there. Like he, like basically can't operate a wet palette. Like it's got like a constant drip of water that's just like feeding into it, because it'll dry like instantaneously. And the certain things are just almost impossible for him to do. Like, oh, I do this, and then I take a minute to blend it. Like, take a minute to blend it. The paint's dry in like 1.5 seconds. Like, okay, well then that's a totally different situation. And then
Wow.
when you're using an airbrush too, like those things matter. Like
Yes.
the
Yes.
humidity of the air matters, because that affects how quickly those droplets are going to dry, either in the air or on the model.
Right.
And rattle can priming is a perfect example. People that have problems with like that kind of speckly appearance
Right,
showing up on their
right.
models, you'll
Yep.
tell them like that's a climate issue.
Yep.
And so you're asking me to tell you like how many inches away you should be spraying from, and I can
Right.
kind of tell you, but that's also a climate thing, and you might live in a completely different place than I do, and it changes everything.
Oh, so speaking of, well, not speaking of spray cans, but it does make me, I did want to ask you about how do you, like, do you varnish or seal minis when they're done?
I do.
And can you tell me, like, how you do that or what products you use?
Yeah, so I've gotten into debates with people who are like, you don't need to varnish minis. I'm like, I'm a commission painter,
For sure.
and like protecting that paint job is like of utmost importance, even if it's just to make sure it's protected until the person gets it and
Right.
opens the box. Like, it's just got to be bomb proof. So for me, everything gets gloss varnished.
Okay.
Everything gets a gloss varnish. I just use a Liquitex artist acrylic gloss varnish.
Oh, okay.
And I make sure that the paint has to be dry before you varnish. So
Sure.
if at least 6 hours, and if it's going to be less than that for some reason, I'll be hair drying it for a period of time to just make
Okay.
sure that it's pretty dry. And then you gloss varnish it. And then it usually, if you want to do things by the book, you should probably leave it for at least 12 hours, or like overnight. Let it really cure and dry.
Sure.
Then do a second coat of something. So if I really need to bomb proof it, and it's like a metal mini and it's like really special, then sometimes it'll get two coats of gloss varnish and a matte. But I always finish off with matte,
Okay.
and I will use either. For a while I was using Liquitex or Winsor & Newton matte varnish,
And were
but
you airbrushing this?
airbrush. I always
Okay.
airbrush all my varnishes. I don't use rattle cans for anything.
Okay.
It's just cheaper,
Sure.
and it's easier to not deal with the climate issues with around. I live in New
Right.
England,
Okay.
so it gets really hot and really cold, and it's also really humid most of the year. So you know, rattle can, like when I first started out and I didn't have an airbrush, you know, priming was an issue because there were like, you know, 17 days a year that you could prime and it was safe, you know, unless you had, because I didn't have a, like an indoor place to prime.
Right.
So I wound up getting an airbrush really early for those reasons. But now for my final varnish, I use Dull Coat, Tester's Dull Coat.
Okay.
But I don't use the spray can. I buy the little bottle of Dull Coat lacquer.
Okay.
And I just pour it in my airbrush and spray it.
Wow. Okay.
It smells horrible.
Oh yeah.
That would be, it's foul, but it's, it works really, really well.
The rattle can smells foul as well, but it's tiny. Like it's a little tiny can for like $10.
Well,
it's not,
I'll tell you, this bottle is $3. I bought it for $3.59 last year.
Wow.
And I am 2/3 of the way through. Although I only just started using the Dull Coat for everything. So if I had been using it the whole year, I probably would have finished this bottle. But it's still $3.59.
Yeah.
And
that's all right.
I've definitely varnished, you know, at least 100 minis with 2/3 of this bottle.
Do you thin it at all?
No.
With anything? No, you just pour, you shoot it straight.
But the Dull Coat layer is only there to change the finish because I've already hardened it with the gloss.
Right. So it's just this final pass.
It's basically just a final pass,
Does it do any, do you find the Dull Coat, does it do anything detrimental to like, so I'm kind of scrolling through your feed here. Like if you have any, you actually don't have, it's kind of weird now that I'm going to ask this question. I'm scrolling through looking for weapons of this type and there's actually not that many, but like, so metallic finishes on like weapons, does the Dull Coat, is it okay on over the top of what you kind of want things to look metallic, or
it changes things? It definitely changes things. And I am now just starting, like in the last, I'd say two months maybe, I'm starting to be way more specific about where I put the Dull Coat.
Okay.
And not varnishing the metals with the Dull Coat.
I gotcha.
I think the new thing that I've started doing is varnishing the whole metal gloss, then coming back with the Dull Coat, but actually like coming in as if it was, rather than just, usually when I'm varnishing, I'm treating the airbrush like a spray can. Like I'm just, I'm out wide, I'm pulling back far on the trigger and I'm just covering. But now what I'm doing is I'm literally airbrushing like I'm painting it with the Dull Coat and staying away from all the metallics.
I gotcha. Yeah. Very strategic then. Cool. Okay. Yeah.
That's
curious
new
about that.
So, I mean, I've only done that the last few projects.
One question is, and I'm scrolling again through your website and I keep keying in on Invocatio. He's a 75 scale. Dude, he's awesome. I love that model. I love your paint job and everything. So
thanks.
I'm just curious, can you tell us a little bit about how you photograph your models? Like what your setup is like and, you know, how you do the lights and the backdrops?
Yeah. So I can tell you what my setup is, but I'm not sure that it's the best setup, so I wouldn't necessarily recommend it, but it's what I use. So I went on Amazon and bought a booth. It's like a soft-sided Velcro cube.
Okay.
And it has a LED ring in the top. It has a hole in the top in case you want to like pull the flap over and then you can shoot straight down.
Okay.
It has, the front has a couple of flaps that you can kind of open up. All of the inside is Mylar. So it has LEDs from the top, but the light reflects off of everything because the entire inside is reflected.
I gotcha. Nice.
And then I hang backdrops. I actually just used adhesive-backed Velcro and put it on the back of the photo booth, and then I added the same adhesive Velcro to a couple of backdrops that I bought on the internet, and then I just put those in and turn on the big light. I actually started taking my Ott light that I use on my tabletop and bringing that in as well because I found that the temperature of the light's better.
Oh yeah.
And just having an additional light source is better. So
sure,
the other thing
fill in the front
that I've started doing that's really important, I think, and I'm not I know that you're like a professional. I am not a professional when it comes to photography at all. My photos suck, actually. They're terrible. I need to get a real camera at some point. I'm still taking, I had a camera, a point and shoot, but it was actually found out it was worse than my phone. So I started taking all the pictures with just my phone, but I actually eventually need
to
get
not a bad photos.
Professional camera.
They're not bad at all.
But the other trick that I do is if you're primarily taking pictures for Instagram, your photo needs to be square or, you know, pictures on Instagram are square, but I don't take the picture square. So that means I'm I'm going to be cropping it to square,
right.
Which means that part of the photo is definitely getting cropped out. So what I do then is I use a white photo, because my phone doesn't have a manual white balance,
right.
Like a really specific manual white balance. What I do is I take a white photo reference card and I place it in the shot where it's going to get cropped out.
Oh, nice.
And then I use Snapseed on my phone. It's an app that Google makes. It's like Google owned. And you can really easily, it has a drag and drop white balance tool. So you open up the photo, you click on that tool, you drag and drop to the white card that you have in the photo, you white balance the photo, then you crop out that whole section anyway.
Nice. Just goes. All right.
So once I figured that out like a few months ago, I was like, oh, that changed everything. Like that's,
yes.
My photos are far more consistent now.
Yes. Yeah. They're totally like, at least the most recent batch, yeah, very consistent. It's that's an excellent tip, man. Good technique. And what is the actual backdrop material? Like, so you buy these backdrops, it's like, I mean, I've seen backdrops, but they're like, you know, 9 feet long or whatever, right? They're big cloth things.
Oh yeah. So, what is it? I don't know what it actually is. It's like printed on some sort of, I don't know, neoprene. It's like some sort of mesh. It probably is the same stuff, but it's just smaller. I mean, I think it's similar to, there's a company, can I mention
the
company?
Yeah, absolutely,
sure. The company that I bought them from, I'm not sure they're even still around, Hangar 18 Miniatures.
Oh, yeah, I've heard of that company.
Selling, I think they're in Colorado. They're the ones that I bought those photo backdrops from that I use. I actually have been meaning to buy more.
If they're still around, I'll drop a link in the show notes so people want to check it out. I want to check it out because I like your backdrops, and I kept going, these look like those like giant portrait backdrops. Not giant, just like typical portraiture backdrops.
They come in different sizes. I think, what do I have? The smallest ones I have are like 10 by 17 or something.
Okay.
Or maybe even smaller than that. I think it's actually, they're almost, I feel like they're almost like 8.5 wide. I think they're like 8.5 by 15 or something. I don't know.
Yeah, that's fine.
But they're small.
Much smaller than 10 feet. So yes.
Well, but my cube is a 2 foot cube. My photo booth, it's 2 foot by 2 foot by 2 foot, so it's got, well, actually maybe it's 28 inches, but it's small enough that whatever it is I have fits inside there.
Nice. All right, very cool, man. That's very helpful. Good tips, man. Okay, my last question is, this doesn't have to do with hobbying, but you manage multiple social media outlets. You stream on Twitch, you have a presence on Facebook, you have a presence on Instagram. How do you manage like deciding what content you put where? How do you manage your social media as a miniature painter?
Well, I wouldn't say I do a very good job of it. If I were to rate myself, I'd give myself like a C+ maybe. But how do you manage it? I mean, one, I think, is you have to understand how each one of those operates and what people are looking for on them.
Right.
So, not that I even feel like I've mastered it, but I think that's part of it, is just figuring out what content to put where people actually would care about it. The other thing is sometimes content just gets duplicated. Sometimes you're just like, you know what? It goes everywhere.
Right.
This
All
photo
right.
I'm posting, like sometimes I'll take some photos of a model and I will post it on Twitter and Facebook and Instagram and everywhere, you know?
Okay.
And other times something will just go into one platform because I think either the people that I engage with there, it fits better. You know, I don't use Twitter much. I'm just not good at it, and I don't really even understand it. But, like, if I just wanted to make a bunch of, like, weird comments to, like, get a conversation going, Twitter's probably where I would drop it,
sure.
Right? Like, Instagram, it's just, like, most people aren't even going to read it because they just look at the picture and just scroll back by.
Right.
So, and some of the – I've also abused platforms to automatically post to – other platforms, like you can make an Instagram post that'll automatically post to Facebook and Twitter.
That's true. Yeah,
but you probably, if you really want to be effective, you probably have to cater the post. So, and I've been really lazy about this lately. This is why I give myself a C+. But when I post something on Instagram, I'll also send it to Facebook. But what you should probably do is go to Facebook and remove all the hashtags. Because people on Facebook don't use hashtags, and seeing 17 hashtags listed is weird for a Facebook post, but it's not weird for an Instagram post.
Right.
So the same post can actually exist in both places, but you just have to cater the content just a tiny bit.
All right. I mean, this is all good stuff, man. To me, it's just cool to hear what other people are doing, whether or not they're professionals or good at it or not, or not good. It doesn't matter. Like, to me, it's just cool to have information out there. You know, I think that's helpful for people. So thank you very much for offering those bits of advice. So yeah, man, this has been totally awesome, dude. I really appreciate your time and I love your work. Like I said, I have a list here of particular ones. I love the Prospero that's on your Instagram, his colors. That guy's great. The Massive Darkness Army, 88 figures. That's awesome.
That was crazy.
The Bursar, I guess Discworld Bursar, which I know Discworld is a series of books. I didn't know there were miniatures, but I love, he's just a cool miniature. That's a cool sculpt, and you did a great job on that guy. And then there's just all kinds. There's a lot, all your work is great. So I'll put links to all your stuff in the show notes. But just to wrap it up, can you just tell me, tell people whatever you want to say, like wherever you want people to find you, or if you want to, you know, pitch your lesson, the lessons that you're doing or whatever, where they can go to find out about that, whatever you want to do to close it out, man.
Thank you so much for having me on. I am Steve Houndstooth Miniature Painting, and you can find me on Twitch as Houndstooth Minis, and also on Patreon as Houndstooth Minis. And I stream on Monday, Tuesday, Thursday, and Friday. And the schedule is on the page. If you just go to twitch.tv/Houndstooth Minis, you can find the info there. And on my Patreon as well. And if you're interested in signing up for either group lessons or private lessons, you can do so through the Patreon under Houndstooth Minis.
All right. And we're back in the studio. I never left the studio. I don't know why I said that. At any rate, thank you so much, Steve, for hanging out with me and chatting. Lots of informative conversation there. It was very cool, very informative stuff, eye-opening as far as commission stuff goes and the scope of the work and how Steve gets things done. I was really surprised by his answers to my questions about how he Twitch streams because, as some of you know, I Twitch streamed for about a year and a half. I played the game Minecraft and I would stream. But in the middle of that year and a half, I did take a break from Minecraft and I did paint miniatures while streaming. And the whole thing, while I really thoroughly enjoyed the process of talking to people and having the community and just, it's so cool to interact with people. But there was something that really wore me down without me really even, I say really a bunch of times, something wore me down psychologically without my even realizing it until it just sort of snapped and I had to stop streaming. And it was that bifurcation of my attention span. So having attention on a product, on an activity that I'm doing on the desk or the game or whatever it is, and then splitting my attention to hold a conversation and make sure I didn't miss any comments or things like that and reply to everybody's comments and things like that. My brain couldn't keep up because I'm old. I can't multitask that way, I guess. I don't know. It was really kind of a bummer to stop doing the streaming and stuff, but I thought it was very cool how Steve pointed out, like, hey, his community is really okay with him, like, you know, missing comments or taking a bit to respond to comments, because I think there's a lot of audiences out there that wouldn't necessarily be as forgiving as that. Although maybe people who watch miniature painters just innately sort of understand that, oh yeah, you're doing a physical activity, you know, you're gonna like have to concentrate there for a little bit to make sure you get something done. But anyway, I thought that was super informative, and I really want to thank Steve again for coming on to the podcast, for sharing with me, and just having a good time. It was great. And again, you can check out all the links in the show notes, but you can find Steve on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitch, and on Twitter. On Twitter, he's HoundstoothMP. At everything else, he's HoundstoothMinis. And yeah, you can also find him at Patreon. All right, let's knock out a quick hobby progress and see what's going on. Welcome to Hobby Progress, where I try to keep myself on my toes by making myself finish things just so I can talk about them on this podcast, in order to make me finish more things so that I can talk about them on this podcast in order to finish more things. Yeah, see how that works? Okay, anyway, this week's very quick because, number one, I'm recording this podcast 2 or 3 days earlier than I normally record podcasts, so my week is short. Bottom line is, I didn't get very much done today, but I did paint one figure and I knocked him out in, I think, about 2 hours. And it's an Iron Golem from Reaper Bones Black. So he's made out of that sort of vinyl material, but it's definitely, definitely better than the white stuff. And since he's just a big Iron Golem, He's pretty tall. I don't know, maybe a 4-inch tall miniature. No, 3 inches. I don't want to exaggerate there. It's about 3 inches tall, but it's just a big, he's all made out of metal and stuff. So I use some bronze paints, some bronze and coppers from Scale 75 and P3. And I did a bunch of washes and some rust stains and some verdigris and just sort of hosed them down with all that stuff. And did a little, based them up real quick with my standard grass and flowers and stuff. And yeah, I think he came out really cool. Pictures of him will be on Instagram on Thursday, the day after this podcast comes out. I think I'll post him. So yeah, that's what I got done. One miniature. But hey, I got one done. So how about Section Charlie? All right, this Section Charlie is a little bit different. This is the first time I'm going to do a shout out or highlight a non-person. It's a thing that I found online. If you're a miniature painter, you might dig it. It's a paint chart. It's specifically a paint mixing chart, and it's from P3, and it's for their paints. But the reason I wanted to kind of highlight it in this episode was I think it might be valuable for any miniature painter, because even though you don't have to have P3 paints, I mean, even though their paint chart is showing their paint chips with their paint names, you can just visually eyeball like, okay, these are similar colors. But the interesting thing that I find about it is the way that it uses some unexpected colors to make the shade colors and the highlight colors. For example, if you go to look at like a Citadel paint chart, and there's like, okay, a particular kind of green that you want to paint, you know, the Space Marine armor, then there's going to be, you know, it's going to say there's the base color, here's the shade color, like the actual, like the wash kind of color, and then here's the actual layering color, the base color, and they're all going to be a series of greens, just sort of progression, like a gradient of these dark to light greens. The interesting thing on this P3 paint chart is like, for example, if I look at this, they have a color called Bloodstone, which is a really nice, rich sort of leather brown, kind of very similar to maybe the Doombull brown from Citadel. When you look at the column, they have one column that just shows you the base color. So that's the color you look at, like, okay, this is the main color that I think this, I'm going to paint on this, say this cloak or whatever. Then the next color over is the shade color. And the shade color for Bloodstone, which is a leather brown, the shade color is Signar Blue Base, which is this dark, well, it's dark, but saturated blue. And then after that, there's the highlight number one, which is Rucksack Tan, which is a tan color, as you would sort of expect. And highlight number two is Menoth White Base, which is a very yellowish off-white color. This paint chart is meant to be that each color, the shade color and the highlight colors, are actually meant to be mixed with the base color in order to achieve the actual highlight or shade color to be painted on the miniature. So it's very interesting to see the Bloodstone, which is a very warm, reddish leather color. They're suggesting you mix this blue paint to get this sort of bluish undertone. And I think it's actually really cool. And it's kind of in line with what I've heard from other miniature painters, like real top level guys like Vince Venturella and Sam Lenz and stuff, where they're always talking about getting contrast into your shadows, you know, getting like cooler shadows and warmer highlights, that sort of a thing. And this P3 chart, I was just like, oh, this is kind of like how they built this paint system to work. Another example is the very first one in the paint chart. The base color is Sanguine Base, which is a really dark red. And the shade color is Gnarls Green, which is a really dark but saturated green, right? And so you mix those two together to get the shade color, the shadow color. And then, of course, the red gets progressively brighter when you mix it with Sanguine Highlights and Menoth White Base to make your two levels of highlights. I thought it was interesting, and I think it might be cool for people to check out if you want to just try something to get these mixed contrast colors and on a model and see what they look like. And always remembering that the idea, of course, is that they're not saying use this blue or this green unadulterated, like just putting that into the shadows, mix that green or that blue with your base coat to get your shadow color. your shade color. That's it for today, guys. Thank you so much for hanging out. I hope you liked the episode. Again, you can contact me at crymo.com. You can hit me up on Instagram, Facebook, or Patreon. You guys have a great week. Wish you all the best in your hobby endeavors. I'll be back soon. See ya.